Okay, it's really nice to be back. So, the basic idea is to describe in some sort of algebraic or geometric terms the Hilbert space of 3D n equals two theories. What I mean by Hilbert space is a space of supersymmetric ground states, not the entire Hilbert space, which would also be lovely to have a geometric description of. So in particular, I want supersymmetric ground states that are annihilated by two of the four supercharges of the theory. And I should also say that we could, in principle, study this Hilbert space on any sort of surface, sigma, with a choice of complex structure. So in general, one expects to get Hilbert spaces labeled by a surface, and they're all extremely interesting. But for the talk today, largely for simplicity, and because there are still enough details to be worked out in the simplest case, I'm going to restrict to the simplest case. So I'm just going to take sigma to be a disk. So in this case, I want to make a preliminary proposal for geometrically how to describe that. Why is this interesting? Suppose from my perspective, intrinsically, it's a cool thing to study from the physics. Even the simplest 3D n equals two theories have extremely non-trivial dualities. Dualities are sort of the lifeblood of a quantum field theorist. In four dimensions, you study exciting things like electric-magnetic duality, which lead to geometric Langlands, and they're extremely difficult on the physics side and on the math side. In three dimensions, they're really, really simple dualities. The most fundamental one is a supersymmetric version So the most fundamental duality is a supersymmetric version of something called particle vortex duality. Which has been really central to a lot of theoretical and practical studies in condensed matter over the past many years, and has come to prominence again recently. This and much, much more complicated dualities in 3D theories have usually been studied by computing things, various observables, including supersymmetric partition functions and supersymmetric indices. And an index is just a partition function on something like S2 times S1, or maybe in an appropriate setting, some surface times S1, or the one I'm interested in, disk times S1. And there are a set of rules for starting with sort of combinatorial data of the 3D n equals two theory. And producing from it some elementary functions that get put together to construct one of these partition functions. Various functions that build the partition function. And often when presented in particular to a more mathematical audience, one just says, look, there's some data here. There is some black box that turns it into functions. Let's study the functions and their functional identities. And what I would like to do is to really start filling in this arrow and making it pass through geometry. And maybe a better way to say that is sort of more fundamental TQFT considerations, where you take the data of this theory very seriously and apply TQFT methods or some sort of honest mathematical methods to understand the supersymmetric sector of the theory, and then have partition functions as something that just comes out of that. So that's the goal. There are several ulterior motives. One of them that I should really mention is that an answer to this question should have really important consequences for the sort of big class S story. So there are a whole set of constructions coming from compactifications of the 62 comma 0 theory on manifolds of various dimension. In particular, if we summarize very briefly, if we start with the 62 comma 0 theory on compactified on a real two-dimensional surface C, better way to say it is a complex curve C, one gets 4D n equals 2 supersymmetric field theory. Putting the 6D theory on compactifying out on a three manifold M, leads to a 3D n equals 2 theory, precisely of the kind that we'd like to understand better. This is for a closed three manifold, and then if we put the 6D theory on snake eating an elephant, on a cobordism, between two different surfaces, CNC prime, we end up with two 4D theories connected by a domain wall, or a supersymmetric interface labeled by that three manifold. So in particular, there are lots of interesting dualities. There are electric magnetic dualities of these 4D n equals 2 theories, and all huge class of the interfaces that implement these dualities come from three manifolds. And there are 3D n equals 2 theories sitting on the interfaces. One of my larger scale goals is to categorify these interfaces in other words, to produce something like the supersymmetric Hilbert space of an interface and express it as some sort of bimodule for the category of line operators on either side in the 4D theory. categories. That's all I'm going to say about that. A really simple example of such an interface theory, or really a three-manifold theory, is the theory associated to the tetrahedron. And I'm not going to say exactly what sort of structure is involved in talking about a tetrahedron. But the simplest 3D n equals 2 theory is the theory of a tetrahedron. And this is then called it's the theory of a free chiral multiplet. And it's the one that's involved in the particle vortex duality that I was talking about over here. In fact, there's a particle vortex triality that just comes from rotating the tetrahedron and noticing that if you rotate it by a third, it looks the same. This sort of three-manifold can be viewed as a cobordism between two squares. It is a manifold with extra data on the boundary, indeed, which...
It's the lowest, lowest object.
Yeah, and it's a building block for other things. And it can... So most fundamentally, it's a cobordism that flips triangulations on two-dimensional triangulated surfaces. When discussing these 4D n equals 2 theories in the infrared, their physics is encoded not just in a surface, but in a surface with an ideal triangulation. And these things act as cobordisms of these ideal triangulations. One can glue a tetrahedron to a triangulated square on two sides to get another triangulated square where the diagonal has flipped. Right, so it's this simple theory that implements that, but then in a triangulation game, there are various relations among flips of triangulations. In particular, there's a famous pentagon relation, which says if you take a triangulated pentagon and flip diagonals twice one way or three times the other way, you end up with the same thing. Homotopy, I guess, between that relation between flipping twice one way and three times the other way is another duality of these 3D n equals 2 theories. So the pentagon, or from a three-dimensional perspective, the 2-3 move, is embodied in this fundamental duality between supersymmetric QED and something called the XYZ model in 3D. So these are the sorts of things that I want to make less mysterious, hopefully. So how do we compute anything? The inspiration that I'm going to use today came from some recent work of Braverman, Finkelberg, and Nakajima in the study of 3D n equals 4 theories, particularly their Coulomb branches. It came from their work in mathematics and also a sort of physical interpretation of their work that we discussed with Davide, Justin Hilburn, Matt Bullimore, and Hee-Chul Kim in a paper from last year. Let me review what happened in this BFN story for 3D n equals 4 theories, and then try to generalize it to the 3D n equals 2 context. So the goal of BFN and a lot of physicists could be phrased as trying to construct a certain topological ring of local operators. So in the 3D n equals 4 context. So these are special versions of the theories I want to consider with twice as much supersymmetry, and in particular with predetermined interactions. So in this context, I wanted to construct a ring of topological, maybe topological ring of local operators. By topological, I mean that the expectation values don't depend on position. So this is a standard sort of construction in the 3D theory. You can imagine inserting local operators at a bunch of points and computing their correlation function with the path integral. In supersymmetric theories, there are special collections of such operators that don't feel each other. You can insert everywhere, and there's a well-defined product on them. So we wanted to just describe this algebra with the collision product. They're characterized physically. These operators, for what it's worth, are in the simultaneous cohomology of two supercharges. The supercharges commute with each other. There are long discussions that come out of trying to make sense of that statement mathematically. I don't want to have one. There are apparently some issues with saying simultaneous cohomology of two differentials, even when they do commute with each other. Anyway, physically what one does is look at things that are killed, look at the kernel of both of these modulo, the image of both of them. They do commute. I'm not sure there is one. It has derailed a previous conference. So these operators are completely characterized by that property. Their expectation values are holomorphic functions on the moduli space of vacua of the theory, in particular, the component of the moduli space of vacua called the Coulomb branch. Maybe a better statement is one can construct such a ring whose expectation values give functions on the Coulomb branch. So the ring is just the algebra of functions on some space. The problem is that the operators and the space have been extremely difficult to study. The operators include disorder operators that are described as monopole singularities at a point, which makes them difficult to study physically. It's a hyper-Kähler manifold that has a full SU2 isometry rotating the hyper-Kähler structures, so you can talk about it as a complex manifold in any one of these structures in an equivalent way. It's a non-compact hyper-Kähler manifold, and in all cases I know, it's affine. I'm not aware of the theorem that it should always be affine. So talking about the ring of functions is as good as talking about the space itself. Sorry? No, it's right. So either it's affine in all complex structures, and how best to say this? Sorry. So it usually comes to you as a singular thing, in which case it is affine in all complex structures. You can partially deform or resolve it, in which case it's affine in a generic complex structure. Right. So then you should rotate your complex structure a little bit so that those compact directions are not holomorphic cycles. Which is fine. It's a perfectly, yeah. It's Taubnut as a complex, in particular as a complex symplectic manifold, multi-centered Taubnut is C2 mod Zn. Is a resolution. Yes, but when I'm talking about whether it's affine or not, I'm gonna move on.
Pick a supercharge that gives you a complex structure.
Fine. I'm not dodging difficult things. I can make this clear later, probably after the talk. So I just wanted to say this was it was difficult to study this moduli space of vacua. Describing it in a generic 3D n equals 4 gauge theory was an open problem since the mid-90s. It was known in some particular examples. For example, Seibrig and Witten wrote a paper about the Coulomb branch of pure SU2 theory, which ends up being the Atiyah-Hitchin manifold, which is a smooth and affine in every complex structure. And there's, right, so moduli spaces of monopoles come about as these things, but anyway.
Is it not a partial compactization?
No. It's exactly that. For Coulomb branches of four-dimensional theories on a circle, you start getting partial compactifications, but this is just that. How do we describe this thing? So a useful perspective was to take the 3D theory and think of it as quantum mechanics. I must always visualize this as quantum mechanics in a cylinder. So quantum mechanics on time, either time C or time times disk, where the space of fields in the quantum mechanics, actually called the target of the theory, is all field configurations on the disk. So yes, one certainly should. I'll talk about that in a second. So this is a humongous, unwieldy target space, but it can be, well, let me actually say what it is explicitly before reducing it down. So explicitly an algebraic language, the 3D theory is labeled by a compact group G and a quaternionic representation that I will assume comes as a copy of a unitary representation and its dual. Then this target is the set of triples EXY, such that E is a GC bundle on the disk, and X and Y are sections of an associated R plus R dual bundle. This is a holomorphic GC bundle. R plus R dual are holomorphic associated bundles, but X and Y are not necessarily holomorphic sections, which is what makes this a horrible thing to study. So to reduce it down and make more sense out of it, we notice that there is, in fact, a superpotential on the space, and we localize to critical points of the superpotential. So in this case, I should probably say, strictly speaking, this is tensored with the square root of the canonical bundle on the disk. The superpotential schematically takes the form of an integral over the disk of y contracted with the covariant holomorphic derivative of x. And then if we ask for critical points of the superpotential, we get a somewhat nicer moduli space. I'll call it MD, moduli space on the disk, which is the same sort of data as before, triples EX and Y, such that E is a GC bundle, but now X and Y are holomorphic sections. And also, coming from differentiating with respect to the connection in here, yx, which formally is the GC moment map in the fibers, vanishes. So the space is this modulo complex gauge transformations. And that was the same over here. So that's a whole lot better. It's still not quite good enough for the reason that was pointed out, that if we're working on a disk, we should really have some sort of boundary conditions. So also, and this is a feature that will show up in the n equals 2 context as well, this space is highly singular. There's this constraint, xy equals 0, which should be interpreted in some sort of derived manner. In other words, if there's a superpotential whose critical locus is singular, one should not be allowed to just classically restrict to the critical locus. One should use dw to deform some differential acting on the bigger space. Yes. No. That's exactly what one should do. Yes. So even that. So in fact, Nakajima wrote this down. in his first paper on the subject and said, you know, we should work with the sheaf of vanishing cycles, and they never figured out how to do it. A much better thing, and something that physically you have to do if trying to understand, say, the Hilbert space of this quantum mechanics, is to choose a boundary condition at the boundary of the disk, or if you think of this as C, you still have to choose some sort of boundary condition at infinity. So we want to choose a boundary condition. For this, to describe this in rough terms, or what a boundary condition is, one notices that this space is coming to you as a symplectic quotient. It's in fact a symplectic space, and these are holomorphic symplectic space, and these are holomorphic Lagrangian boundary conditions. I'm just going to give you some examples. Picture. They like pictures. The picture is this. Here's the disk. We're going to specify what the fields do at the boundary of the disk. So B is a boundary condition at schematically at the boundary of the disk. One good choice which is implicitly what BFN chose, is to simply set half of these fields to zero. That's very good for a number of reasons. In particular, it trivializes the superpotential constraint. So if y is zero on the boundary of the disk and it's a holomorphic function, then it's zero everywhere, which in particular means that xy is zero. This leads to some subspace of this, which just involves x. So it's pairs E and x such that E is a GC bundle. X is a holomorphic section. This is Neumann.
The language of bundles.
Sorry?
The language of bundles, what does it mean?
That there's no restriction. An alternative, which is the one we studied in more detail, call this BFN. There's an alternative, which I'll call B vortex, which, very rough terms, sets half of the fields to be non-zero. At the boundary of this disk. This also interacts nicely with the superpotential in a slightly different way. So if x is non-zero at the boundary of the disk, the superpotential uniquely forces y to be zero, which means y is zero everywhere, which means w is zero everywhere. So this also ends up resolving, but not in the usual sense of resolve. It ends up ignoring that singularity. It leads to the following sort of moduli space. Setting the fields to some non-zero constant at infinity breaks the gauge group there and trivializes the GC bundle. So this trivializes the GC bundle at the boundary of the disk, or if we think of this as C at infinity on C. And that leads to what's usually known as vortices. So I can describe moduli space in two different ways. First, let me write it down. So it's space of GC bundles and EXY. It's basically space of EX. It's GC bundles with X holomorphics, X non-zero at infinity. Say X goes to some constant C at the boundary up to complex gauge transformations. And this breaks up into components. So the nice thing that happens when trivializing the bundle at infinity is that suddenly there's a well-defined notion of degree. One can, I think the pedestrian way to think about this is that one can integrate the first Chern class and get an integer on the disk. Algebraically, one says that one can compactify to CP1 and describe this as bundles GC bundle on P1 with X, a holomorphic section that goes to C at infinity on P1, and this breaks up by degree of the GC bundle. So this is a disjoint union of components labeled by degree. To translate to physics, though, I'm sure it's not necessary. There's flux, right? There's quantized flux through the disk, and it's conserved. Okay, either of these is fine. This is still infinite dimensional, but in fact, it's contractible, and it's fairly easy to deal with. These things are finite dimensional. They're also, they're not contractible, they're finite dimensional and also easy to deal with. In either case, maybe I'll move back to the other side of the board. So in either case, we can compute the Hilbert space of this quantum mechanics, which is the supersymmetric Hilbert space of the underlying 3D n equals 4 theory. The answer is different. It depends on the boundary condition. So you get two different Hilbert spaces. In either case, the Hilbert space shows up as the Durham cohomology. What one would expect is the Durham cohomology of this MDB. So for sort of the BFN boundary condition, this is just the equivariant cohomology of a point. Space is contractible. For the vortex boundary condition, this is a sum over degrees of equivariant cohomologies. Back to some group that I'm not discussing. Of these vortex moduli spaces. These are the sorts of objects I'm interested in today, at least in generalizing these. The goal in BFN and in physics was to construct these Coulomb branch operators, and that's one extra step on top of this, which is to figure out what the supersymmetric operators are in this quantum mechanics. That can be rephrased as, since quantum mechanics is one-dimensional, is what is a particular class of interfaces in this quantum mechanics. And that comes about by replacing, so if we want these operators, we replace the disk with a double disk that's surrounding an operator. Or look for boundary conditions for two copies of quantum mechanics, and compute the Ramka homology of that with the same sort of boundary condition at infinity. And this leads to, so the moduli space of this sort of thing with the BFN boundary condition is some version of the affine-Grassmannian. And so one ends up with cohomology of the affine-Grassmannian with a natural action on this Hilbert space. There's a similar thing in this setting. Anyway, there's a lot of beautiful geometry there. Okay, so these, well, if depends whether I turn on an Omega background. Yes, exactly. So it's I've been trying to phrase things in geometry and pictures rather than algebra. So a moduli space of bundles on a double disk is a correspondence between bundles on single disks, has maps to both disks. And so cohomology of this, you expect to act on uncohomology of a single disk. This is not quite such a nice infinite dimensional space, and there are issues, and the Ramka homology has to be replaced with Borel-Moore homology for reasons that physically I still don't understand, but that can be made sense of. So, what about 3D n equals 2? So the theory has the same sort of data as the 3D n equals 4 theory, generalized a bit. So there's a compact group. At least this is for 3D n equals 2 gauge theories. There's a unitary representation that does not need to be accompanied, at least at this level, by our dual. Can also introduce a superpotential, which is basically a fiber-wise polynomial or invariant function on this representation. So this is a holomorphic superpotential. And there are also Trans-Siemens terms that show up in these theories generically. So being extremely loose, there's a matrix of Trans-Siemens levels, which lives in something like H4, BG, up to some shift. Okay, so that is a slight enhancement of what we had before. There are a few important differences. There's less supersymmetry. The theories before had twice as much, 8 versus 4 now, for those counting. We're still going to do the same thing. We will rewrite the theory as quantum mechanics and look for some supersymmetric Hilbert space in that quantum mechanics. However, in this case, it's not going to be a Durham-type quantum mechanics where we end up with Durham cohomology. It's going to be a Dalbeau quantum mechanics where we end up with rather bigger Hilbert spaces, because the supercharge, the only one that's available to us, acts as the del bar operator. So in the 3D n equals 4 theories, there is a more general differential available, which led to these topological rings and acted as Durham. So maybe another way to say that, just in words, in the 3D n equals 4 theories, the local operators had a topological structure, or at least one could choose supercharges such that their cohomology gave rise to topological operators. Here, there's still a differential, but its cohomology only depends topologically on time and is holomorphic in the disk direction. Structure is a little bit weaker. And so one doesn't get full simple algebras of operators, something like functions on a space, but one rather gets vertex algebras if one were to study local operators. Anyway, idea is roughly the same. So we rewrite as quantum mechanics, where the target is field configurations on the disk. Explicitly, it's a set of triples, EX gamma, where in algebraic language, E again is a GC bundle. X is a section of an R bundle, as you would expect, and gamma is written with a Greek letter to point out that it's a fermion. Gamma is a section of an R dual bundle that's thinking, and what I think of is Kevin's language, though it's probably more general mathematical language, is shifted. So there's a bosonic and a fermionic bundle on the disk that X and gamma are sections of. There's a homological grading throughout this. R has even grading and R dual has odd grading. So as before, this is too big, but there are two superpotentials. They impose two sorts of conditions. One of them imposes one of them restricts us to the critical locus of this W. Right, so I called them both superpotentials. This is a superpotential in the ambient, the original 3D theory. These are superpotentials from the point of view of quantum mechanics. So one of them imposes criticality of W. The other one restricts X and gamma to be holomorphic sections. So then we get the sort of space that was familiar from before, with some slight modifications. So
the condition that W is a field does affect X and not gamma?
As far as I can tell, yeah. I would actually very much like it to affect gamma. So if there's some way to understand that, that would be great. I don't immediately see it coming out of BPS conditions.
That's good.
Maybe somehow indirectly it, when adding appropriate differentials and reducing the space to something simpler, it does actually affect gamma as well.
Gamma gets masked, right? Like this.
It does. Indeed. There's a Yukawa coupling involving a superpartner of X and gamma with D squared W. But it's not sitting in the BPS equations. So physically there is a potential that I probably should be using. There's a mass. So it's roughly the sort of thing one gets is the space of EX and EX gamma such that DW is zero and X gamma are holomorphic. So we end up with a nicer moduli space with the same caveats as before. If DW is singular, we should be careful and do things in a slightly more derived manner. And as before, we can and should impose boundary conditions. So we choose boundary conditions. It's the same picture. Now, the fiber of these bundles is shifted symplectic rather than symplectic, which is fine. We want the Lagrangian for that shifted symplectic structure. It looks like something holomorphic with respect to X and the conormal bundle of that with respect to gamma. So this is some sort of Lagrangian in a shifted symplectic space. And then schematically what one expects to get is that the Hilbert space is the Dalbeau cohomology of MD with boundary condition gamma. So I think I have a minute or so left. Let me maybe discuss some of the very basic examples that at least indicate that this might actually be computable. You might also argue that the examples are a little bit too trivial, and so it should be interesting to do this more generally. Let me take that free chiral tetrahedron theory. Here the group is empty. The representation is C, and there's no superpotential. X, gamma are sections of a C plus C shifted bundle on the disk. While there is no, actually, let me just write down the space. So MD is just the set of polynomials of bosonic and fermionic polynomials in the holomorphic coordinate on the disk. while there's no gauge group, there is a symmetry group sitting around. In fact, there are two of them. There is a U1 that in physics is usually called U1 flavor that just rotates the phase of X and gamma with weights 1 and minus 1. And there's loop rotation. U1j, so it's loop rotation. Maybe I want it to rotate z with weight minus 1. So these are symmetries that can that commute with and the del bar operator acting on the space. So we expect that the Hilbert space will be a non, well, in general, you expect that the Hilbert space will be a representation of the symmetry. If they commute with the del bar operator, the supersymmetric part of the Hilbert space is going to be a representation of the symmetry, which is great because this is a huge infinite dimensional thing, but it does have finite dimensional graded components. There are several nice choices of boundary conditions. Let me just discuss the simplest one. We're going to set gamma to 0 at the boundary of the disk. Then MdB is just polynomials. X of z. So this is graded. This is a direct sum of c z to the d, c to z to the n over positive integers n. And we want to be taking Dalbeau cohomology of this. And this is hopefully for many people a familiar exercise. So it's just the product of a bunch of copies of the Dalbeau cohomology of C, which is infinite. Doubly so. If we take the character of the space, taking a trace over the entire space with minus 1 to the homological grading, Q to loop rotation and X to flavor grading, the trace is something very nice. It has a 1 over 1 minus X coming from the Z to the 0 term, 1 over 1 minus QX, 1 over 1 minus Q squared X, and so on. And this is an old friend, the quantum dilogarithm function. That's that story. Let me just very quickly say what happens for the dual theory. So there's particle vortex duality here. There's rotations of the tetrahedron. So the dual theory is a U1 gauge theory, where the representation is again C. So we're looking at, and the superpotential is 0. We're looking at U1 bundles, or C star bundle, on the disk, where x of z, gamma of z are holomorphic sections. And the dual to that boundary condition over there is the vortex type boundary condition over here. And dual, b-dual. So the vortex type boundary condition says set x to be some non-zero constant at the boundary of the disk. This means that the space splits up according to degree of the U1 bundle. The upshot is that MDB becomes a disjoint sum of MDB with a fixed degree. Now, in order to have a non-zero section, this degree has to be positive. That ends up, so x with in a fixed degree, x and gamma end up becoming sections of OD and O minus D. So if the degree is positive, x can be non-zero, gamma has to be zero. So each of these things is a set of polynomials, x gamma of degree D. And we compute Dalboka homology as before and find, taking a character, that the trace over this space is a sum over degrees. Now the space is graded by degree, and so we can include some variable that counts degree. And then there's the character of the Dalboka homology of the space of polynomials, which is 1 over 1 minus q, 1 minus q squared, 1 minus q to the n. And this is d. So this becomes x to the d over something known as q to the d, Pockhammer symbol, which is by a very famous identity, is exactly the same as the quantum dilogarithm function over here, written in a very different way. And that's all I have time for. I will say that there's also something called the Q binomial identity, which is encoding in this language the pentagon relation. So all of these sort of very classic identities of Q hypergeometric series end up, well, first there's some sort of indices of the 3D equals 2 theory on a disk that was known, but more interestingly, they end up encoding some sort of dualities between these Dalboka homologies of moduli spaces. The very interesting thing to do would be to actually make those functorial, and it seems to be possible and on the horizon. All right, thank you. It's yes. So the original space is a direct sum of vector spaces. The cohomology is a tensor product. Is a tensor product of Dalboka homologies of C. Each Dalboka homology of C gives something like 1 plus x squared plus blah blah blah, and then we're taking a product over them. Sorry, I went a big fast. No, I don't think it is. I mean, just
Probably.
I'm quite sure it's not, because if you look at how the symmetries act, here there's simply there's just a U1 symmetry of the space that just acts by rotating the phase of the sections. Over there, that symmetry is getting mapped to the degree grading. I want to say a similar sort of thing. There are a few different choices for how to get a compact surface. But I would expect the same thing where these sections are twisted by the associated R and R dual bundles are twisted by the canonical bundle in order. Sorry? Indeed. Sorry, that's always. Yes, you do. You need W to respect the homological grading. Is that same? So at a basic level, I expect something that looks roughly similar, but I haven't computed anything for more general surfaces. Yeah, it should be very interesting. I agree. Oh, sorry. And Davide would tell you it's some space of holomorphic blocks.
No. I'll say, but hey, on computer indices.
Indeed.
The level of mantra.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, thank you.